We're sitting here in Bellagio on the edge of Lake Como. We're here because we're part of an art and science conference organised by Don Forrester. I'm sitting with Marlene Dumas. Marlene, you've just given a presentation to the conference, but let's start somewhere. And let's start by talking about the portraits that you do. And not being overly specific, when you paint the portraits, I was wondering, what are you actually attempting to explore or look at or communicate or express? Because, as you said earlier, you're not necessarily working in a highly figurative or representational way, but what is the sense of that person that you're trying to capture in those works?
How far should I go back, actually? When I was a student, I did a mixture of things. I did some figurative works, and I also did things where I only made marks. So I was very mixed up between exactly what I wanted to do. And in the first years in Holland, I also didn't use the figure anymore. I mostly used words and collages. And then I think the first portrait or face that I made in Holland was actually the wife of Freud. It was called Martha Sigmund's wife. And because of of all the psycho analysis in art theory and that, I thought it was very nice to paint his wife instead of him. Because he was all around, but you never knew how his wife looked like. And his wife looked a bit like an angry version of my grandmother. My grandmother was called Martha, also painted. I then painted three Marthas. Martha, the servant girl, Martha, my grandmother, and Martha, Sigmund's wife. So in a sense, it had to have a likeness of them. That's also why I used a photographic source to help me with that. And then the other aspect was sort of what they stood for, in a sense. That was another reason for making the portrait. And in a painterly side, on this, I was actually influenced by the fact of what's his name, the Kooning one said, if you want to put something in the middle of a canvas or so, just put it there. So I eliminated all backgrounds and everything. So in a sense, the face became so big that in that sense, it had on a formal level, a certain abstraction.
You actually come originally from South Africa, and you've made a large painting with a whole series of black faces, let's say. But from what I can gather, it wasn't in any sense to memorialize or create icons of these people. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that, because by selecting black faces, there's obviously an implied statement there about race and about people that are grouped in a particular way. But what made you make that work?
At that stage, also, there was this big thing, controversy of that you don't speak for somebody else, and I also never wanted to speak for somebody else, so I had never specifically done something like that to make a work that had in a sense racial implications. And because it was so loaded and a difficult subject, but then I thought that on the other hand, it's also so strange. I paint my grandmother, I can, in a sense, because the works, all my works is in the sense, I used to explain explain why and this and that, but they're so simple really, because you have a face or faces, and you've got a body, and you've got a history of painting, and so in a sense, the more I answer about it, the more I almost tell the viewer how they should look at it. Well, they've got such a lot I've made it so easy already, in a sense. And the difficult part is, what do they think about it? So it's not that I'm trying to be difficult, but in a sense, it is more, I think, what in the end, the meaning of the work sits more in what happens to it when it's finished and goes into the world than where the starting point is.
And I mean, we were talking a little bit about that in a way today, about ambiguity and about the incompleteness of some artists' work, with the notion that the viewer completes it. And when I look at some of your works, they don't actually tell me everything. Sometimes I feel the medium is eluding that very literal story.
With my work, on the one hand, because of the titles so often, and also because somehow in the work it feels as something has happened before or something is going to happen, it seems that a lot of people read it like that. Well, if they look at Vermeer of Lady with Pearl, then they don't ask the same type of question.
No, that is interesting, because with a Vermeer you feel it is somehow or other the definitive statement. I know things will happen after and things happen before, but with a number of your images I feel that there's something in the process of happening.
Yeah, I know, but I have tried to, and I've said many times, you know, I'm like looking at myself as a third person. But I must say, sometimes I think, okay, I'll let somebody else try to work it out. I don't always know. I mean, I speculate on certain things too. I know I like the tension of, and maybe, although as you say, today also we were talking about the ambiguity almost as a quality of all good art. So then I also felt a bit bad one to say, you know, ambiguity is my thing, because most art of our time almost deals with ambiguity in some one way or another. But I don't. How can I say? Is it because I like images that's got a certain, a little bit of threatening, or it's got a, is it only due to the time that it's made in war, people, when I'm all dead and gone, look at it totally differently? For example, the four babies I've done, the origin of the species, people have written about it, also woman writers, you know, that they look like monsters and this and that. But the longer I see them, the friendlier they look to me. The only thing I did was that I made the scale bigger, so a small thing when it's something that's often used that creates, obviously, some, not necessarily alienating, but effect on one if, you know, something is small and it suddenly becomes big, so it's not something I invented. So the babies are bigger, I remember when I made them in that time, I was looking also at, you know, who painted babies, and most of the baby pictures that I knew, paintings, were reasonably soft. And so although you've got a painting of Frida Kahlo of her own birth, and you've got a few others, but so in a sense, I wanted to, you see, that's also why often, as I say, I'll come back to the first question, I suppose. Life is hard, yeah. You do start looking. But probably when I'm supposed to answer a totally other question. Because sometimes, because I've often said this thing, I use second-hand images and first-hand emotions. So in a sense, because my daughter was born, I was extremely busy with the fact of a baby. How does it feel? How does it look like? What is a baby? So, but it wasn't. But it was also a challenge then, as making an image of that. How would you tackle that? So it was two different things, or different, but related things. But why am I saying that? The hardest situation. I mean, it's the same thing with the black drawings. You know, when I was making it, it was obviously not that babies isn't really that neutral, and neither is if you pick out one group of people, although it makes you realize that if you have a group of white people, that seems to be the norm, and that, you know, why doesn't one say, oh, what's so strange about a group of, if I call them, I've got a group called Chlorosis, which is all a little bit light green, and I always tell where that comes from, but people are always less interested to hear that, yeah, than about the black drawings. So, as you said, the questions that are asked, or one is aware that at certain times, a certain subject matter is more loaded, even if nobody, if everyone wants to say it's no problem. So the same thing with the babies, in a funny way. I don't know if they are so gruesome. Because after that, I'm not saying I was the first, because I don't find this first thing so interesting, but a lot of women, younger woman painters, did a lot of children and babies and stuff. And I got people saying, oh, they're so pleased I did the baby, because they always wanted to do a baby, you know. Mm-hmm. And so now I think maybe in a few years, if you look back at that, one will not see it as so monstrous or something. And
I don't know whether you'd agree that a kind of consistent theme in your work, or consistent theme in your area of interest, includes love, eroticism, sexuality, the use of what's called pornographic imagery. Can you talk a little bit about what you think is important enough about that area of imagery to work with? What are you trying to kind of express or unpack there?
Well, firstly, I think that one, I always say that to students also, the fact that you are attracted to something doesn't guarantee that it therefore will be a good artwork. But if you're not attracted or committed or for some reason, or disgusted, but in some way attracted to your subject matter, then nothing comes out of it. So I... So that's one thing, that the human figure and face has been my subject from since I was small. That was something that always interests me. So that's an old type of subject. But then it's so interesting. Every time you say, for example, after the faces in the 80s, I did these different faces and portraits, and then someone also mentioned, yeah, but you know, the human face, two eyes looking at you, always has a certain attraction. So I'm simplifying, but obviously then I thought, but can I also make a good painting that attracts you if there's no face on it, if I use the body and not the face? So then you use the body, but you use the naked body because you're not interested, in my case then, in decorative aspects of clothing and that. You want to have it as naked and as vulnerable as possible. But then, so you're not really using the face, you're using the body. Then you get all kinds of problems, yes, but how does that read? But apart from that, never mind what all the readings or misreadings can be, making a naked body without a face looking at you, because we know, everyone knows the story of Olympia, and most of my people always looked at you, so if the subject looks at you, it's got a different effect, obviously, if they're not looking at you. So you know all these things, you're not innocent about it at all. And then, as I always say about more pornographic imagery also, that there is only a few things people do with one another. You know, they either hit one another on the head, or they sit on chairs, or they lie on beds, or they eat. Well, I'm not interested in that aspect. Or they make love, or they die. So, or they can cry. Or something. I mean, but that's why I wish to grow extremely old. I would like to tackle more of those type of very old themes that has always existed in art, and also with the more pornographic image. I'll say more about that now. But you know, then someone said, "Yeah, but why is the woman young? You know, not old." And I said, "I can't do everything at the same time." You know, I asked, "Why don't I have more men?" Yes, I have got men. You know, but so sometimes these questions is a bit off. So I'm not holding it against you, but indeed, I mean, I saw Rembrandt's portraits of himself and getting older and that, and he's one of the few painters in our Western painting tradition who's actually, I mean, there must be more, but that has done such beautiful elderly people. I actually did my two works in, I'm not quite sure the date now, maybe early 90s or so. One was called Porno Blues and the other was called Porno Escolage. And Porno Blues was actually also to do with the fact of our whole type of everything turning a bit pornographic, the overexposure and the problems with the naked body. And there's this lady is actually sitting there all alone in a sort of mirror, and she's sort of got a bit the blues. And but it also, as a whole, had to do with the fact that although there's so much sexual imagery around, everyone seems to, or not everyone, but have a bit of problem with it if you talk to them individually. So that was, but Porno Escolage, for example, people never wanted to talk about, but maybe I didn't make it so clear. It was only clear in the title, but I have used the body for so many different reasons. What if I would say I want to make an erotic image and not say I want to use it for, and then it is also very difficult. And so then the pornographic, I use the pornographic imagery in a sense I wanted to see if I could make the pornographic imagery almost erotic. Yeah, I don't know if I can say that because that maybe sounds stupid, but make them erotic. I was thinking, if you are in a relationship, how would one show that difference if you are in a relationship where you do find it fine that someone do whatever they want with you? How do you then paint that? How do you paint the difference between a commercial, you know, etc. So that was the type of thoughts. So that group,
For me, it's very much a faith in flux period for me, because you know, the density of work in the last year has been such that I'm now at a point culminating in the Erebus Serpent piece where, and the ICA show, both of which in a sense built on the idea of self-parody to some extent, in a sense of acknowledging becoming further and further pushed into sort of an expectation of a way of working, which I'd never had. I'd had so much freedom in my lack of kind of success on this sort of scale. It to suddenly be jettisoned into it, and you know, within really a year, I'd say, it's all happened. It's quite uncomfortable, because I mean, I'd been very used to, you know, getting shows, and on the whole, they were in kind of quite low-key spaces or in locations which weren't that high profile. And they were normally sort of never much further away than a year or a year and a half away. But now, you know, people are planning shows for me 3, you know, even 4 years in advance. And you're thinking, well, you know, they're asking me to do a show, but on the premise of which, the work I'm doing now, are they expecting me purely to be sort of like working, you know, exactly the same, or are they just taking a kind of a leap of confidence that body of work during 10 years? Allows them to be confident that I might be able to perform in some sort of manner akin in 4 years' time. But so I do find it kind of awkward because, well, there's not been a great deal of thinking time that's been, you know, just really kind of a free thinking time. It's been very concentrated, intense thinking on particular projects, also bound up with the physical labour that's been involved. So now is very much this sort of period of time when I'm sort of trying to reassess the whole.
Am I right in feeling that there is something at the very core of the work, in the purpose of the work, in its meanings, in its intentions, is fundamentally kind of inimical to this sort of professionalising of an artist's practice?
Well, I think it is a particular problem, the way that the piece couldn't really be experienced in the Tate as it perhaps should be, because of the number of people coming through. So its own success actually undermines the way it's actually sort of should be read or experienced. So in a way, this is something that, to begin with, I've got to address.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even to the point of which, you say in Matt's during the Coral Reef, kind of, there's no invigilator in there, you were let in, and to all intents and purposes, there might be another two people in there, but you might just have it to yourself. And part of the magic of it was that very fact that there wasn't an invigilator standing around every corner. Whereas obviously in the ICA, which I think was more successful in that sense because it was built more for people, you know, to just roam through the whole building, but less so the Tate piece. It was problematic. So, you know, you stand in there and you can hear people, you know, stamping down corridors and slamming doors, and you walk into a small office and there's a man in an orange shirt standing looking bored with his arms crossed. This is something, you know, obviously I've got to address. And I mean, at the moment, you know, I'm working towards the Sydney Biennale,
mm-hmm.
which
right.
I had a... It's not a fully formed idea, it's more a direction in which I thought would be interesting to go, which would be to actually build a whole, you know, a house or a whole structure that sat, you know, within a landscape which then had an interior as well.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the whole idea then of there being an invigilator standing in really becomes preposterous. More recently, I've been thinking about that whole sort of aspect of the invigilator, and if there's going to be an invigilator there, then, you know, maybe it shouldn't be an invigilator, perhaps constructing the piece, you should actually construct it with a character, kind of like the character that inhabits it,
mm-hmm.
sort of like, instead of being a... This is really very formative. It's only
right.
something I've been thinking about since in the last kind of 2 weeks, I'd say. So, as well as building the environment, you audition and dress, inhabit mm-hmm. it with a person that then, you know, doubles as the minder of the piece at the same time, I suppose. Because obviously the work to this point has very much worked off absence.
I was thinking that does sound like a radical departure, because threaded across all your pieces has been the motif of implying the absent presence.
Mm. I mean, again, if we go back to probably the premise of the ICA show, which was a quote from the preface to the 1954 edition of The Universal History of Infamy, where he talks about the kind of Baroque,
mm-hmm.
you know, a definition of the Baroque as being when a person's work becomes so far to this point of almost a self-parody, then it defines it as Baroque. And in a sense, like the Tate piece, where I've made a piece about absence, like the absent storeroom, which is in fact not just in the absence of the inhabitants that run the storeroom, but the absence of a show, which is the Coral Reef, which is present but absent at the same time. So it's like a double sort of absence.
Right, how about the issue of connections between your aspects of your subject matter and recent events, the current political situation?
Mm. Well, that's, I mean, obviously particularly pertinent in the piece in Venice.
Mm.
And the piece in Venice was so bound up with what went on. It's the room which was a travel agent's was kind of prophetic in a sense, in that it was a travel agent's with like a map of global disasters from an insurance company on the back wall, three images of Boeing jets, kind of like from Singapore Airlines on the wall, two shaker storms of the Empire State Building and the World Trade Center on the desk, and an Arabic magazine for reading matter, you know, next to you know, the waiting room seating, which obviously it was built in June. As soon as the actual Twin Towers event happened, I mean, my mind went straight to that room and thought, I mean, it was a uncanny association of objects. And it happened in the middle of building the ICA piece, which mm-hmm. was, the title of the piece was a quote from, you know, Hassan Isaba, one of the, you know, the Persian assassins from the 13th century, nothing is true, everything is permitted, which, when I was given the Hamlin Prize, the person kind of giving the prize out obviously thought that was a rather problematic title in the current state of affairs.
In the way that I've read your work, I've always interpreted the work as very much not about realism, but as a series of meditations on the mediations of real history via fictional forms. So when you say that the coincidence of real events and the content of one of your pieces was a problem. Is that because it kind of removed the layer of mediation?
With the ICA especially, it was... one critic sort of said that I'd been caught out by current events. And in a sense, I had, in a way. I think, I mean, it surprised me the success of such a sort of a terrorist act as it's kind of labelled on such a scale. But, you know, what had happened wasn't that surprising, sort of. It seemed like something was going to happen of this sort of type.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the last few months, this is really what I've been sort of concerned about. But it's, but when it does, something does happen that sort of confirms your sort of suspicions of how the world is, and it's so grotesque, and you know that the world, to all intents and purposes, will never be the same. It's kind of, it was quite depressing. Well, obviously it was very depressing in the terms of that, but within terms of the work, it was very, it's kind of problematic. I mean, I think what you're trying to say is that this sort of distance that people could have, the fictional distance in their heads, when they actually view a piece that deals with that territory, kind of potentially, or not the actual overt thing that happened, but the underlying historical texture of the world and how it is and how it came to be like this becomes slightly secondary. Everybody's mind is at the forefront of the actual event, at the horror, at what's going to happen now, which in a sense is the problem. Ultimately, in the West, but predominantly America, in their self-action. You know, if anybody was asking me, is there a political element to the piece in the Tate? I think the only thing I could say is it's introspection, because in a way this would have been what should have happened within the West after such an event. And, you know, looking in on ourselves, kind of like to see exactly what has happened to cause such an event, I think, mm-hmm. really, rather than just lashing out at people in mud huts in Afghanistan.
I'm going to briefly to return to that Simon Grennan criticism.
Which one was that from? From the trading station?
Untitled, yeah, Trading Station Alpha.
Yeah.
He talks about the fact that there are realities, that there is like real sort of misery and real suffering, not exotica, but real plights, that ultimately form the kind of sources of the kind of fictionalised content of some of your installations. You've got a quote from Martin Gayford on the ICA handout, metaphors, your spaces, your assemblages become metaphors for alternative ways of living and thinking, but I'm thinking that they are not metaphors, they're actually simulations of marginal lives, marginal situations. And I was, I guess I'm still wrestling in my own mind with the issue of cultural tourism and how that relates to what you're doing.
Well, I think, the actual card that kind of went with the ICA show was an acknowledgement that sort of I was implicit within that sort of like cultural tourism, mm-hmm. whether I kind of wanted to be or not. I was part of it. You know, the image of me with the Buddhist monk sort of, which... It was a kind of curious image, because if I was viewing that, I wouldn't know whether that was just a friend of mine who got dressed up, taken to the hills of Wales and taken a picture, whether it was real, as in that it was really with a Buddhist monk, and I was really somewhere, you know, Tibet or sort of like Nepal or wherever it might be, and what was the relationship between us, whether I purposely had this photograph taken with this in mind, or whether it was instigated by the Buddhist monk. So it was a kind of curious, ambiguous kind of position, which, you know, within that ICA installation, I obviously inhabited as well. Every artist in London has spent time in the ICA. I mean, the ICA for me is a complicated place. I mean, I think it's very much bound up with how it's run at the moment. It's a gallery that I don't really like, and like it even probably less, having done the exhibition there. And I think it kind of perhaps comes back again to something that perhaps I didn't notice when I was planning to build the piece in the preface of the 54 edition of the Borges novel. When they talk about this idea of self-parody, it talks about a parody that had been done of the Odyssey, and the fact that kind of like it was impossible to parody the Odyssey because the Odyssey was already a parody of itself. This is what potentially might have been a problem with the ICA show. In attempting to kind of parody the institution, particularly on the ground floor, I was already doing exactly what it did to itself anyway. The ICA show for me is a kind of complicated piece, which I don't think I'll fully understand for some time. I don't think many people will either. I think in retrospect, it'll be a much more interesting piece, you know, in my practice than the tape piece.
Was it actually one piece or was it two pieces?
For me, it was one piece, the whole thing. But the piece upstairs was a parody of myself, more. In a sense, it was a parody of the institution because what I built, to all intents and purposes, was an artist-run space within the gallery. It was, when you entered through the hole in the wall, kind of into the upstairs space, what you found was you entered through the back storeroom of the artist-run space into a gallery space. The exhibition was the room painted red, then through into the back office, which is the gallery office. And obviously the whole piece was dated to 1993 as well. Which, of course, these spaces don't exist anymore. And there's a certain sort of nostalgia, I suppose, both for a different period of time within the art world, but also for a different period of time within my career, an acknowledgement of a shift that we've been talking about earlier on. But also, a desire in my mind at that point to sort of return back to a piece that I never made that might explain other pieces that had been made in the past.
And would part of that explanation have to do with a relationship to artists like Taroni, who you mentioned in the press release? I was wondering up Pistoletto as well, because another of the topics I've got checked on my list is to ask you about your relationship to those kinds of neo-avant-garde practice.
In a sense of I am explaining in that press release exactly why I was going to make the piece in 1993. Perhaps not exactly how I would have written it then, but the explanation of it was as it was conceived at that point in time, in that I was kind of emulating that. Again, the idea of parody is running through the whole thing, because in a sense I'm parodying, I'm emulating the career of Taroni. And I suppose the suggestion was that in 1993, had I made this exhibition in this house, which incidentally was a four-person exhibition with Martin Creed as well, strangely enough, the whole thing was pulled a week before the cards were printed and everything. So in a way, I always felt that I had made it, because I'd visualised it so much. But, had I made it, then this would have been my working practice, that each time I entered a space, it would be to paint the space red. I mean, it was numbered at number 22 to suggest that it was already kind of come in a sequence of works that had already happened.
The particular point that I was trying to recall was, it's about the idea of enacting the practice, that conceptualist practice, but within a terrain of popular culture rather than...
Yeah, it was taking... the reference has been shifted from that of the kind of formal material qualities of art to a rather sycophantic popular cultural reference, I think. That's what I wrote in the press release. Which for me sort of, obviously underpins the later work that comes before, as it were.
Pamela Golden, we're in your new show at Gimple Feast. The title of it is Even the Car is Dead. It's an interesting and intriguing title. Perhaps we could start off by telling me why you've chosen that title.
Okay. The whole series began through research, I guess, like everything else, and I was interested in the first documentary films and sort of how that also was at the same time as a certain type of horror films. And the documentary films I was particularly interested in were Flaherty's films, and the use of panchromatic film. So the first film that people didn't have to wear makeup, you could shoot, and they would look, quote, natural. So it kind of brought up some ideas. And I was interested in looking at kind of Hollywood horror films at the same time. And one of the films that I watched was The Black Cat, with Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi, based on an Edward Allan Poe story. And it's the same story that Rocky Horror Picture Show, it's a familiar story, people get trapped. And part of why I was interested is, in this film, there's a lot about fighting with modernism. both exterior spaces fighting with the interior spaces, things that have to do with nature. And at one point, the couple that are trapped are trying to escape, and this series of things happen. And he doesn't actually say even the car is dead, but it's implied. So that's where it came from.
Okay. Now, if we look at the works, I mean, one of the things about your work is, and you've talked about film a little bit there, film is obviously a very important reference in your work, but you do use fairly traditional media, let's say, in the exhibition we're in now, which is paint on a surface, and you depict your imagery through that process. But nevertheless, there is, in my view, a very filmic, photographic sense coming through them in terms of the kind of snapshot frozen moment. But can you talk a little bit about that relationship? Here you are, very interested in film, but you choose a very, very traditional media.
They do come from photographs, but they're not actually the photographs that you're seeing. I kind of reproduce them, and then they go through a whole kind of process, and they're reinvented, and they're very narrative. I guess I'm interested in how you engage with an image almost as you'd be watching a film. So that's also to do with the size and kind of relating to them that way. These are really different in terms of the construction than the last few series, because they have very bright kind of grounds or underpaintings, so they're almost working like impressionist paintings. And they're a traditional media, but I'm sort of talking about that, talking about painting history, hopefully, that's something.
Because they have the kind of quality of a photograph, unlike maybe a sort of a traditional painting, in that they seem to record the intimacy of a snapshot moment that's there and important, because the actual subject of the image is known to the person taking the photograph. And I wondered to what extent that can be shared, because it's a bit like we all have family photographs in drawers, but when the participants have gone, or they've been lost, or the people are dead, it's very hard to kind of really know what that moment was about and why it was actually recorded in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's... Well, I don't know any of the people in these images, and as they start out, because they're all found, and I think there's something to do with that and how things get discarded. And also what's strange about purchasing them or finding them and what that retrieval is about. But I guess to me it also has to do with how we come upon things in museums and how we look at things in cases and what becomes kind of precious that way. And I guess thinking about these moments in time and these activities that refer mostly to social history. And most of these images are probably around the 70s. Some maybe go a little bit further back. And I guess it just seemed appropriate. And again, linking to horror films, although I was looking at 30s horror films, I think if you think about 70s horror films, it brings in another agenda. And somehow that seemed appropriate for the kinds of paintings, which maybe doesn't make a very logical link, which I guess is the other thing about making, or you kind of set these structures, and then you break all the rules. It doesn't work out that way. You know, you start, or I start painting, and, you know, 3 months later, it's nothing like it started.
The kinds of, I suppose, procedures and methodologies in the films you're talking about, horror films and conventions and documentary making and so on, they have a particular space and time and way of depicting the subjects. And is that something you consciously think about when you're depicting your subjects?
It was very conscious in this series, because I was trying to balance the amount of natural elements with the people or architectural elements. So there was it was actually a balancing act happening. But I was also conscious of things, like I was very much taken with Gosho's first two films that I saw, and they had a lot to do with the first sound films and how he was using silence and how nature was playing into that. So I think it was very conscious.
Let's have a look at the first image on the wall. And the first image, the title of it, is nevertheless A Library, and it depicts a girl of about 8 or 9 in a red dress standing by the side of a building, which in itself is situated within a garden, I guess. And again, it has the sort of intimacy of a snapshot that a parent might take of, you know, their child. And the moment is frozen. And it, as I say, I think the word intimacy comes to my mind, and a sense of timelessness.
I think there's something about it being familiar, where most people have seen that kind of image, and who are we engaging with? And I wanted to have the location sort of mysterious too, and the sky is very pink, and we're not sure if it's dusk or if there's something ominous in the background. And you don't actually engage with her face. It's because I in the past I've used maybe more illusionistic techniques, even using smaller brushes, and this time I was conscious to maybe make them more painterly, to have the brush strokes show. So I don't know if that's answering your question at all. The title, I think I wanted you to kind of think about a whole kind of host of things, and it's just something I was thinking about with this. They don't necessarily tell you that much about the images, and some of the titles were exactly what was on the back of photographs I found, or I was reading a book on tropical architecture, a 1930s book, so some things were from there.
Love those references.
Yeah.
So the actual original images, where did they come from?
They come from a variety of sources. They come from anywhere from flea markets to old magazines, and I try and keep things the same size that I'm finding them. And I have piles of things, and they just sort of come together. But it took about 3 years for this series, so it's a very slow process.
So I was going to ask you about the size, but the size seems to refer then to the size of the original image, which often, if it was from the 70s or 60s, there were sort of 120, some sort of Kodak format.
I mean, even if they weren't exactly that image, I tried to have them refer to that so that you knew you were going back to that time, which brings up all kinds of things, thinking about that time, too, historically, and what was happening. And this first group, they're very much kind of family scenes, I think.
Let's move to the next one, which has a title, It Involves a Pedigree, which seems to have a shot of a woman lying down and slightly exposed on the legs, and a sort of a naked person standing there.
Yeah, the naked person's actually a child. And again, I think it could be, you know, people having a picnic outside in a park or whatever. But I guess with this one, I think I liked how you weren't sure exactly what was happening.
I mean, one of the things that occurs to me is, and I think you mentioned the word narrative, is that I'm intrigued about what came before and what will come after. They seem to be frozen incidents, but they're not clearly totally here, in a sense, in terms of the experience or the story. So they're grabbed, they're frame grabbed out of a narrative.
Well, I guess that's the film references too, because hopefully you can encompass a whole other situation that does precede it and that is going to take place afterwards. And there's, I mean, this one, there's almost an activity about to happen, and we're seeing them from behind. So what are we looking in on?
I mean, one of the things about filmic reality often is that it's celebrating and expressing the spectacular. But in these images, they're sort of between maybe spectacular events. You haven't got events depicted of enormous importance to these people. They're incidental, but they're how we all live in that sort of middle ground of life.
I think I'm interested in looking at that and what that space is about, because that's not something that you really pay that much attention to, and I think sometimes those moments are actually very revealing in terms of life, you know, what happens in that space, sometimes as you're just getting from one place to another, or this one is just some people sitting in front of a windbreak. And I guess there are formal things about that kind of a structure, which is just a weird thing that you'd be sitting in front of, you know, that this kind of temporal tent. I guess that's...
But it could be the kind of the scene, if you like, for anything to take place. Although what we have here is seemingly innocuous, but it looks as though something quite dramatic is about to happen.
Yeah. I think we've all been on beaches or in crowds when things do change like that, and from one moment to the next. And I guess I'm interested in those kinds of things. What does happen next? I guess the colors for me are also important in these, you know, getting kind of some of the formal things that happened, and how you sometimes unthinkingly you place yourself in front of something like this very brightly striped windbreak, and you're completely unconscious about it.
It's the sort of interest in film, I think, is what I want to develop with you a bit, and it's more particular than that. It's the whole process of construction in film, which is a process of editing, and I get a sense structurally that the paintings are almost edited fragments in the way that film is constructed. And tell me what you think are those kinds of interrelations between you, the way you work on the paintings and the filmic process.
Well, I think that's a very interesting tie. I was particularly and I guess that links it to the documentary film and the Helen von Dagen book that I was really interested in, who did all the editing for Flaherty out of miles and miles of footage, and came up with these, basically constructed the whole films. And I think similar things happen in terms of making the paintings, where because they're so slow to evolve, and I do change things around a lot, and they are about editing, making choices, and... Well, I mean, they start out first from an editing process in terms of choosing images that kind of become a series. You keep things for a long time, and somehow they become appropriate at certain times with other things. And then they change as things evolve. And I guess, again, choices of editing also had to do with the size and the brush qualities and kind of those formal things. But also, this series had less single figures, so you were involved in a scene in a very different way. And the single figures are often not looking at you. There's the one of the girl, nevertheless library, but the rest of them, you're actually seeing a whole scene. And there's several... There are like scouts in the woods and boys bathing and three girls looking... for directions called Map in Hand. And those relate very much to a kind of editing that I was thinking about Cézanne and his construction of bathers, where the men became vertical elements and maybe the women were horizontal. You can think of it that way. So it's actually kind of compositional editing as well. I'm very interested in sound and music and all kinds of music, and even though... It's unclear looking at these. I think, you know, at the same time I'm listening to things to make them. I'm constantly listening to things in my studio, a huge range of things. With paintings, although they're silent, to me there is something about creating noise with both the colors and the space.
Mark Fairnington, your show at Mobile Home includes, as far as I can tell, if you like, three different genres, three different types of painting.
Yeah, there are three different series. The largest paintings are from a series called Mantid Eye, which came from a research project I did at the Oxford University Museum of Natural History, photographing insect specimens under a microscope. It took maybe about 30 or 40 shots to get one specimen in, and these were then collaged together to provide the source images for the paintings, and it enabled me to blow them up to a very large scale. The Without Shame paintings refer to natural history illustration, and wall paintings I saw in Rome last year at the Borghese Museum, which combined animals and plants together into kind of fabulous decorative structures.
And the third kind of genre of paintings here are...
They're paintings of people's eyes. They're done on circular aluminium panels. And they came from a painting I did for a show at the Harris Museum in Preston, where they asked me to make a piece based on a painting in their collection. The painting I used was a 19th century painting of a woman's eye done on a very, very small circular brooch. The original one I did was set inside a woman's compact so that it was reflected in the mirror, in the lid of the compact, making the face seem complete. And the first one was a self-portrait. It was my eye.
The Mantid Eye series have the look of a quasi-photorealist image, but you're saying that they were actually constructed from a very large series of shots, from, as I understand it, from slightly different angles, which then went to compose the final image. Am I correct there?
Yeah, I mean, I was using the equipment they had in the museum, which was a microscope with a 35mm camera mounted on the top of it. The only way I could photograph them was to move the specimens around underneath the microscope. So things like points of focus change, the position of the shadows change, and all these kind of differences between one photograph and the next become integrated into the final image. And what interested me about that was the way it kind of reflected how specimens are in the collection, in the sense that I chose ones that had been conspicuously damaged by the process of being collected. You know, they'd lost limbs, the wings were broken or fractured. Nonetheless, their position in the collection is to represent the insect for the scientists that are studying them. And I thought that the way the painting process operated was very similar, in the sense that the process of collecting the material inevitably changed the image that you got in at the end of it. It was really that interest in, you know, taxonomic practices of the 19th century and the fact that Victorian scientists would go out and bring back thousands of insects because that was their method of getting information about the world. And I suppose I saw my journeys into the insect collection being very much like a kind of field trip. You go out, you get everything you can, bring it back to the studio and assemble the best image of the insect that you can from what you've got. In a sense, the kind of flaws in the photographic process, I actually enjoyed using them and I wanted them as much as anything else.
This is interesting because it's tying in with maybe another way of understanding or another way of reading that process. On the one hand, a photographic image or a photorealist image is very often taken as some kind of replica of some hypothetical image that appears on the retina. At the same time, I was thinking of the fact that the actual visual process is very, very different from that, and that very far from being the compilation of a perfect kind of continuous finished image, the actual practice of vision is about a scanning, a fragmentary kind of scanning process.
When you first confront one of the paintings, it's as if you're being given an image of something done in one shot at a particular moment with particular lighting conditions. So that idea that it's a single moment rather than a collection of many moments is your first impression of the paintings. And what I liked is that actually, as you begin to scan it, as you begin to look at it, that gradually falls apart. So, in a sense, the image begins to disintegrate as you look at it and you become aware of the things that don't fit with your initial impression. I think in terms of work that I've done that explores the relationship between painting and photography, that's a very sort of particular thing, in that the photographic image, I think the way we read them, is always as an image that has appeared at a single moment, whereas the intervention of the hand into the painting means you inevitably see it as a construction.
At a recent conference at the Tate, David Batchelor commented that he thought there was a certain problem with the photorealist tradition, with the classic photorealist image, in that it, I think this is a fairly direct quote, that it offered no space for the beholder. It was an image which kind of thrust the beholder back from the picture.
It's never a label I've been particularly happy with, mainly because I don't think it really describes what I'm doing, although obviously there's a direct connection in some of the series that I've done between my work and the work of photorealism. But I think my engagement with the imagery is nothing like photorealist. I mean, I would say it comes more from surrealism, actually. Although the kind of processes and the technical side has a relationship to photorealism, I'd say someone like Vija Selmins is an artist whose work I think I connect more strongly with, thinking about her work in relationship to the work of other photorealists, was a kind of emotional engagement with the subject matter rather than a formal engagement with the image. I think that comes through not just in the way the subject matter's dealt with, but the actual technical process. The other thing about my work, which I feel quite strongly about, is it seems to me to be extremely 19th century in terms of the ideas that it's relating to. I don't know if you can describe yourself as a Victorian photorealist.
Well, I guess technically, you know, given the date of the invention of photography, quite a lot of 19th century painting was drawing very closely from photographs without consciously kind of registering that fact. The fact that with Vija Selmins' work, inescapably one finds oneself thinking about that painstaking actual production process. Clearly, all this work here presents much more kind of complex imagery, actual complex subject matter than a Selmins image. But I'm wondering if you care to say a little bit about what the actual sort of intellectual and creative process is like.
I was most intrigued by working on the large inset paintings, which are maybe 7 or 8 foot square. So a section of the insect's abdomen might be, you know, 7 or 8 inches square, and that's what I'd maybe work on one day. When I'm doing that, I feel like an abstract expressionist. If you isolate those parts of the painting, you know, the brushwork's quite kind of wild and sort of expressive. And once you set up a framework that says everything within this painting is done with meticulous attention to detail, you can almost get away with anything within that frame. You know, once that framework's set up, the brushwork and how you handle the paint can be quite kind of fluid and fairly sort of loose, actually.
Yeah, I was thinking there's something quite schematic about many of those areas. In fact, even, dare I say, quite kind of workaday. There's a sort of pragmatic kind of utilitarian use of the paint in some of those areas that doesn't seem to be attempting a kind of internal, sort of microcosmic kind of decorative effect abstracted from the rest of the painting. It's just serving its purpose to make that image speak at the end of the day.
I think looking across an image, you can see paint being used in lots of different ways. I'm kind of like an ant walking across a sort of very rough bit of ground, you know. So the way people actually read the images, the way people see them, is I think quite different from how I see them.
Did you use a computer, for example, to evolve these compositions?
Yeah, the initial drawings are done very crudely, in a sense, on Photoshop, and then transferred to large-scale drawings in the studio wall and then worked on again.
I should probably give a little bit of detail about the content of these images. They show a collection of animal specimens, things like frogs, hummingbirds, and trailing tendrils of plants. Actually, there's a plant. I'm looking at an image of something which looks like, I think it's a pitcher plant. And so the whole combines to produce a composition which is rather like a very sort of elegant kind of decorative illustration. But equally, I was thinking, it is actually like a Roman grotesque. I wonder about the question of deadness, the grotesque. Many of these plants have kind of dewy substances dripping off them. There's a sort of sense of a sort of deliquescence, a sort of kind of gooey kind of they're kind of exuding these substances. When David Batchelor was talking about the lack of space for the beholder in the photorealist painting, I was thinking that he was referring in part to the very reflective, very steely, very impermeable surfaces of traditional kind of classic photorealism. It seems to me in your work, Mark, there's a slight component of a sort of in-your-face kind of fleshliness, which it has that quality of pushing you away from the surface of the canvas. Are you trying to menace people? I mean, is this a sort of surrealist menace going on here, or what?
No, I think with the eye paintings, the way I wanted them to exist was as though the painting and the frame are one and the same thing. They would be like objects you might come across in a kind of provincial museum somewhere, you know, but that is how they are and that's how they always have been. And I don't know if this is about alienating the viewer, but that they'll go on being like that whether you're there or not, you know, and they might get tucked away into some kind of cupboard, but that's what they are and that's how they'll be, really. It's a sort of sense that they exist as objects out there in someone's collection, you know, and that's what I wanted the frames to work, really.